Hello, Black Swans. Today I'm going to badmouth the practice of high anchoring. I remember once hearing an entrepreneur say, "I've never lost money on deals I didn't make." And that talks about high anchoring, not going too cheap. I'm going to give you an example of a Hong Kong cab driver that's still trying to learn this lesson and how it costs this guy money. And this is about negotiating smarter, not harder. So high anchoring, bad idea. High anchoring makes deals go away. High anchoring leaves you with an empty cab. I'm in Hong Kong recently because I was lucky enough to have the Hong Kong Police Department's hostage negotiation team invite me to come out and speak, which was awesome because my book has recently been published in Chinese. It's been published in a total of 13 languages so far, by the way. But I'm in Hong Kong. I'm doing a little sightseeing. And I take a cab from downtown to get up to this great view of the city in an area called the Peak or Victoria Peak. Magnificent views of Hong Kong. Absolutely gorgeous city. I'm lucky to be there at all. So I look around the Peak for a little while. I'm getting ready to leave. Now there's a tram to get down. The tram's about an hour and a half wait to get on the tram easily, or I can go look for a cab. Now it's cost me about 60 Hong Kong dollars to get up there. It's 7-1 rate of return. 7 Hong Kong dollars to every 1 American dollar. So about 60 to 80 to get up there. So I go find a cab line. There are three cabs, and I notice people walking up to the cabs, talking to the driver, and then walking away. So I walk up to the first cab, and I lean in, and I show him the address to my hotel, and he looks at me, and he says, $480. What? What? It's like Pulp Fiction. Say what one more time. Look, it costs me $80 to get up there, and this guy wants $480 to get back? I mean, that's nuts. That's why people are walking away from him. I walk up to the next guy. He wants $400. The third cab, he wants $400. Now, I'm getting a little worried because I'm cold. I'm tired. I want to get back to my hotel. I'm jet-lagged. And I'm thinking, can I even cover this? And, you know, I happen to have enough in my pocket, but, you know, these guys should be wearing masks as far as I'm concerned. So I decided to go back to try to cut a deal with one of these guys. And just as I'm approaching the three same cabs again, people are not making deals with these guys. Fourth cab comes up, and I show him the address to my hotel and ask him how much. He points at the meter. Now, I figured, you know, the meter was about 80 to get up, 60 to 80 to get up. It ain't going to be anywhere near 480 to get back. So I jump in this guy's cab and take the meter down. It ends up costing me $60 to get back down. But the point is, just as I was getting ready to pull off in the cab that I got into, the first cab, the guy who'd been high anchoring, he drove off with an empty cab. I'll bet you that he drove all the way down the mountain with no fare. High anchoring has caused every deal for him to go away. And yeah, you know, you do lose money on deals that you don't make, unless you got something better to do. And this cab driver didn't have anything better to do. Careful of your high anchoring. Coming in with a high price too soon, too early, without finding out what's going on, it's going to make deals go away. Deals you should have made by asking some good open-ended questions. What happens if we don't make this deal? What happens if you don't address these problems? Good thorough discussion in advance before you start throwing out numbers.
Connecting the subtleties behind what they say to a life narrative, to deep-rooted value, to emotional meaning, that's when we really start to get down to the nitty-gritty. And it is very hard to hear those things, especially when the other side is hell-bent on throwing numbers at us. Right? Because every so once in a while we get into a negotiation where the other side seems to be, no matter what, we are going to haggle over this number. And that's why I'm here today. For those of you that deal with procurement, or maybe you're on the procurement side, you probably find yourself very frustrated on the phone with a procurement person that has no idea about the last 18 months that you spent with their internal team creating this program, creating this system, and all the intricacies that are involved. And then they put some new schmo on the phone that's from procurement and says, you got to take 20% off. And that person does not understand all the trouble you went through with their internal team to build where we are. And we're already cutting costs because we're trying to make it work. And now I'm talking to you, want to get another 20% off, right? And then we get caught up in, no, I can't do 20%. Well, you have to go 20% and we can't do business. Well, maybe we could do 10%, right? And you're already compromising against yourself What is the deep-rooted value issue that is overlooked when you're talking to this procurement person, right? Because they've hit you with an anchor, right? You got on the phone and you got smacked with an anchor, and it's called an anchor on purpose because it feels like it's tied to our legs and we are sinking as a result, right? It is designed to cause emotional turmoil in the person that is being used on. The exact same reason the great philosopher Mike Tyson said, right? Everybody's got a plan till you get punched in the mouth. And that's what anchoring is designed to do. And we can get so caught up in, well, how do we name price first? Well, how do we combat this anchoring? And at the same time, we're overlooking the deep-rooted issue. And so if a procurement person is on the phone, I'll give you some insight into this already if you haven't already heard it. If you are someone who speaks to a procurement department, if you are talking to procurement, who has the leverage? In a procurement negotiation, right? You're you, we're us, and we are talking to procurement on the other end. Who, in fact, right, when we think of leverage in a traditional sense, which is not something we bring up often, but it's worth understanding and wrapping our minds around, because we're going to deal with people that think in terms of traditional leverage, and understanding how to influence that mindset starts with us understanding the reasons behind this traditional leverage idea. And so what do you think? Who's got the leverage there? You're on the phone with procurement. They throw a high anchor at you or a low anchor at you. Who's actually got the leverage? Is it you or is it procurement? Keith, you do. And go ahead, while people are typing up stuff in here, Keith, if you could add to that, what makes you say that? You say, I got the leverage when I'm talking to procurement. What makes you actually say that? And while we're thinking this through, another way to look at this is, I can now ask them questions. Ah, very good. That's a good start. And if you want to continue to build that out, what else makes you feel like you got leverage in a traditional sense? Please add to that. Another way to look at this, and I imagine a lot of you are familiar with it, because I know several of you have read the book and have done the masterclass as well. In a hostage negotiation scenario, who's got the leverage when it comes to the traditional sense of leverage? Is it the hostage taker or is it the victim's family? And when I say victim's family, right, the people who are negotiating on behalf of the victim, it's usually a representative of the family if we're talking international hostage negotiation, or a government representative from that country, as opposed to an actual American FBI agent like Chris Loss on the phone personally. But who's got the leverage in that sense? The hostage taker or the victim family, right? And this is very similar to this procurement approach that I'm talking about now, and also in general sense of traditional leverage. Ah, all right, we got some good stuff in here. All right, so Keith, right, you can probe more for their point of view. Very good, I like that. I will add to that, Keith, there are some predictable things about their point of view that inform you when you go deal with a procurement representative. One of the things that's very predictable is, for all intents and purposes, their job is on the line with every single deal that they make. And they are personally worried about getting fired if they don't make a good deal, which is why they're happy to be an attack dog, because they're not gonna lose points for being an attack dog and jumping down your throat. They're gonna lose points for losing deals. And so that instantly makes you the one that's got the leverage, because their job is riding on you, right? Their entire future is riding on you. And that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on them, and they get yelled at, right? But if you're in procurement or ever have been, you got a boss that walks by every once in a while and goes like, get it done, right? They're constantly got people breathing down their neck. Let's see, Donnie, if they give price first, I have info I can use a counteroffer. Very good. And Lyle, which I may have totally butchered that. Please forgive me. when it comes to the hostage negotiation, right, the victim's family, because there's only one buyer, whoever's the less desperate has the leverage. Ah, another good one. Very good, Christopher. Right? This idea of he or she who cares least wins. And we have complete control over what our outward persona, what it dictates, right? What it indicates. And right, so all of this is a really long way of saying, right, for all intents and purposes, we can throw traditional bargaining or traditional leverage away because it's an emotional concept that will get us confused. It's easy to say the hostage taker has all the leverage because they got our, you know, they got our mom, they got our daughter. But exactly Lyle's point, they have one buyer. Right. If you think of a hostage negotiator, or a hostage taker as a business in the private sector, if you had one other business in the entire world that would buy your product or service, how much leverage do you actually have? Right. And that's the position that hostage takers put themselves in. With procurement, they got one company on the entire planet that has built this system or this process that's been designed over the last 18 months to help their own personal company grow. And part of what's even more important than making this deal that they, where they cut the legs out from under, or chop the legs out from under somebody, is if they lose it at all, they've thrown 18 months of their company's very specific efforts to design a new system out the window. And that hurts them way more than whatever the price point is, right? And so we can get really caught up when it comes to this anchoring idea and this traditional leverage idea. We can get ourselves wrapped around the axle on it. Now, what's great about anchoring, as I mentioned earlier, it puts us in the perfect spot to say, how am I supposed to do that should the situation or the moment allow for it? The other thing that is also very, very apparent when someone throws a high anchor is they got a lot of movement. They got a whole lot of movement. And I will tell you, and this is something I struggle with personally, one of my triggers, as it were, that drives me nuts. And I got to get better at this. When I feel like someone is anchoring me, I feel like it's a completely manipulative move. And at that point, it's like, well, you know, the gloves are off, right? We're no longer back boxing with these 12-pound gloves on, right? Now this is a bare knuckle fight. This has just turned into a street fight, and you set the stage for it because you threw the anchor first. So that's the first thought, right? They're going to have a lot of movement if they anchor first. Leaves us in a place to say, it seems like you're willing to walk away. Or how am I supposed to do that? Or it seems like you got a reason for throwing that number out there, right? It gives us any number of options when they go first. The biggest caution, right, in addition to what I mentioned, is this idea of splitting the difference. That's usually the result of anchoring, which is the main motivation for why we named the book the way we did. And, right, the cliche that I'm sure you've all already heard, he or she, I'm going to screw this up now. He or she who defines the distance is often a poor judge of it. And I know I didn't get that completely right, but where we're going is, right, when they've defined this anchor, chances are whatever the midway point is that has come up as a result is still above where they'd be willing to settle, right? The point of anchoring is to move the midway point because splitting the difference is such a common thing. And so if I anchor at 600, and I'm willing to settle at, you know, at 2 or something like that, right? Chances are I'm going to end up somewhere around 3 and I'll still be better off, And so because of it's such a manipulative approach, it tends to set me off. And I guess where I'm really going is, don't be like me, right? And get so angrily triggered by an anchor. Instead, look at it as a point of information gathering that better informs us on what their mindset is and what their ability to be collaborative is, right? Another kind of check off is if they're willing to anchor, then they're probably not looking to be collaborative. When working through a price negotiation in general, these two phrases are something that we want to avoid as best we can. The you got it. Even if someone gives us exactly what we want out of the gate, responding with, I agree, let's do it, you got it right away, unfortunately, because of human nature, will lead to quote unquote bad blood after the fact. That's the best way to have your counterpart walk away from the deal and go, damn it, I should have asked for more. They agreed too damn quick, and I knew it. We put ourselves in a bad spot. I never should have agreed to that, and they'll lose sleep over it. Even if they've made a great deal for both sides, because of the way the emotion was managed in the moment, we agreed too quickly, and we made them nervous. One of the greatest examples of this I love, when Chris was with the Joint Terrorist Task Force in New York, which has now been disbanded for reasons I won't go into, but they made some great cases. One of the cases that they did was TWA Flight 800, which at the time, there was an aspect of that investigation where they had to identify all the boats in New York Harbor of any size that were on the water at the time that Flight 800 blew up off the coast of Long Island. Now, if you could imagine New York Harbor in the summertime, and identifying every boat from like government battleships and submarines that are in the Hudson, all the way down to one person kayaks, and having to identify all those boats and then talk to somebody that was on that vessel at the time that the plane exploded, that's a pretty big investigation. That was just an aspect of this. And so the guy who was in charge of that was right underneath Chris. And cell phones back in those days were a big deal. And he came to Chris and he said, right before a big press conference, he said, you guys, you, John, and Tommy, who are the three big case agents, you guys are going to get all the credit for this, right? I did a huge part of this investigation and I'm not going to get any accolades. And so I want a cell phone. That's what I want. At the time, Chris knew he could get it. He knew he'd have to jump through a bunch of hoops and, you know, may even have to talk to the president, but he could make it happen. But he didn't want to fool around with this guy. And he looked at him and he said, you got it. And let's just call the guy Jim. I don't remember exactly what his name was. His instant reaction was, damn it. I should have asked for more than that. Even though getting a cell phone was going to be really hard, that was not indicated in Chris's demeanor. The guy didn't have to work for it. And so, it sounds manipulative. Managing the human emotion is, we got to be very aware. And then the I'll try piece, I think a lot of you got a feel for this. I'll try is very similar to maybe. If we get an I'll try or maybe or we'll see response from the other side, assume that it's not going to happen. Don't ever look at an I'll try or maybe as maybe it'll turn into a yes. Because we're setting ourselves up for failure. And so if we get this response, first thing we need to be aware of is like, okay, we are in a bad spot. If they're positioning themselves or they feel like they need to waffle as their best option right now, then clearly there's something wrong with our trust. There might be a common ground issue here, but there's an unresolved problem that has led them to teeter-totter so much. So that should be the first thing. We probably need to back up. I'll try. Sounds like we missed something. Sounds like we got to back up a little bit here. I'll try. it seems like I'm making you nervous. Right? So that's the first thing. You're probably in a bad spot. You need to back up. And then moving forward, you know, and also culturally, everybody's got this I'll try thing, right? In the Middle East, in Arabic countries, inshallah is their version of I'll try or maybe, right? In some Hispanic parts of the world, right, Latin countries, mañana, we'll deal with it tomorrow, right? That's another version of the same thing. So every culture's got a version of this. If we hear it, at the very least, we know we're in a bad spot and we got to back up and readdress some things.
Well, let's say you and I are bargaining or negotiating, and then I tell you I can't pay that price. I should absolutely stay strict with that number, right? Because if I move from it, let's say I'm willing to pay more, wouldn't that make me look like a liar? Because I said I can't do it, but then here I am saying, okay, I can pay a little bit more. So I'm just wondering, if I say I can't do that, should I absolutely mean it and not move from it? Because if I don't, I'm afraid I'll look like a liar. Long-term relationship might be damaged.
That's a great question. Okay, so if you are the one who's saying I can't do that, which I think is the angle you're coming at it from, right? If I was saying it, and if you were saying it, what I would suggest is pretty much exactly what you said, not to move off the number. Right. When we do not say things in the attempt to manipulate, we say things in an attempt to influence and then let people know what our positioning is. If that's your true position and you want to be honest about your position and you go to that number and that's it, then I would suggest sticking to that, which is part of what the phases of no that we're getting into here in a second. Right. We'll address. So personally, I would say, yeah, if you're going to do that, stick to it, live by it, don't come off it, right? Use tactical empathy to say, I know I'm a jerk. I know this makes me sound terrible. I would imagine that you're thinking all of these horrible things about me since I said that, right? Like hit them heavy with those things. Now, vice versa, right? Flip side, you're dealing with somebody else who says, I just can't do that. Now, I'd love to say that more often than not, those people are being honest. They are genuinely exhibiting that they can't move any further. Unfortunately, we also all know that that's not always the case, right? There are those people out there that is technically a category that people who use a phrase like that fall into. But unfortunately, we know more often than not, it's probably a manipulative thing, or it's another way to, when people don't know how to exhibit it physically or with their voice or in an emotional standard, this idea of he or she who cares least wins, right? That's how people will try to articulate that with those words. I just can't go any further. And then you get them to move a little bit more. Perfect example of this is like Pawn Stars. I don't know if anybody's ever watched Pawn Stars. They are a great show to watch when it comes to, like, if you just want quick repetition on what human beings look like as they're going through into the emotional roller coaster of bargaining. What are some real simple things that people react to? Pawn Stars is a great thing to watch. And I would suggest, like, go on YouTube, type in like Pawn Stars, like craziest deals. And you can spend 5 minutes watching like 10 straight bargaining scenarios and really watch how people tick, which is really interesting. But there's somebody who does that. They go, that's my bottom line, right? 22,000. Like, oh, how about you do 24? No, 22,000. I can't go any further. And then they come up to like 22.5 or something before it's all said and done. And so that's another place where if you're getting that, responding with a form of tactical empathy is always going to be more effective than using a number. Something to the effect of, it sounds like you're getting a lot of pressure internally. It seems like I've put a lot of pressure on you as a result of making that ask, right? And then throw in more accusations, audits. I'm sure that I look terrible. I'm sure that makes me look really greedy. I'm sure it makes me look like I'm trying to be uncollaborative on purpose, right? Hit all those things And then for the purposes of the exercise we're talking about right now, right? What's the no-oriented question or the thought-shaping question that you throw on the back end of that tactile empathy to get them to come off that, this is as far as I can go. Now, in the rare case that they fall into the category of being completely honest, they'll probably start to get a little angry, but not really angry. The people that escalate from 0 to 100 right away, that instantly go from being, maybe they were a little bit angry the whole negotiation, and now they're spilling over the top. Or they've been completely calm the whole negotiation. Now we've gone to the price discussion, and they immediately are going boiling over. That is a tactic. That is all that is. People have those individuals, and more often than not, assertive types. They have learned that they can make people move, take any sort of movement whatsoever, just by exhibiting so much anger. What's really interesting about these people, and this is kind of a separate topic, is those are also generally the ones that say, I like to keep emotion out of business, right? Business is not an emotional thing. And then they come in and go, ah, rah, 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 rah. And it's like, what's happening here? The hypocrisy is hurting my brain right now. But great question, Chris, right? If we're using it, stick to it, be honest about it. We are never going to condone lying. And then if it's the flip side, you get it from the other side, chances are they're probably not honest. What else do we use to kind of combat that? It's going to be a form of tactile empathy combined with a label, ignoring the question, thought-shaping question, which you all are going to work on right now. I love labels. I think you all know that at this point. A label that I started using a long time ago that's bared a lot of fruit for me is simply, it sounds like you got a range in mind. Because the reality is, human beings do not walk into a price discussion without having a feel for an area that they might want to land in if they know they're going to talk about price. There's just no way around that. And so knowing that to be a fact of human nature, seems like you got a range in mind. Sounded like a good way to start, right? So we started experimenting with it. And I'll tell you, the first time I used it, I should have stayed in dynamic silence longer. I'm still kicking myself to this day. This is, you know, 9 years ago. I'm still kicking myself over it. Talking to an analytical CEO, I said to him, it sounds like you got a range in mind. And he goes, yeah, I think that's fair. And then I started talking again. You know, I fully expected him to lay out his range immediately. And when he said, yeah, that's fair, I got all up in my head. And I was like, oh, my God, that's all he's going to give me. If I stay silent too long, I'm going to make him angry. And he's CEO. And I was 24 at the time. Right? I'm like, this guy, you know, he's been in business longer than I've been alive. And I got all this stuff going on in my head. And I started talking immediately. There's the only change that I would make if I could go back and do it all over again is stay silent, right? When he went, yeah, that's fair, which is a response you all might get as a result, sit in the silence. For all intents and purposes, they didn't give you anything to give back to them. And so be content to sit and wait until they do. And so that's the first part. Now, let's say I counted to 1,000 Mississippis. Which is not a huge possibility, but it is on the scale of possibilities, right? However small it may be. Then I would have followed up with, would it be a bad idea for me to ask you what that is? Would I be overstepping my bounds to ask you to elaborate on your thoughts? But essentially, following it up with a no-oriented question. So, accusations audit, right? I would have done that. That's going to sound intrusive. Sounds like you got a range in mind. Dynamic silence. And then if I count to 1,000 Mississippis, follow it up with a no-oriented question. And so, keep that in mind. I mentioned a couple of thought shaping. How bad of a position do I put you in? What sort of additional pressures do I put on your shoulders? by asking this, by asking what your price is. Another thing that we know to be true is there's always a team on the other side. And so leading in with, I know that your company would not walk into a situation like this without having really considered your position. You got people on your side that are all incorporated into decision making. How bad of a position do I put you in by asking you what you guys discussed as a team before you came today? Right? That's a great way to unintrusively talk about, I know this to be true because you're smart people. Smart people come in ready to go. What did you guys discuss? Right? And so that's another, these are all ways of when we start thinking about changing the what's your budget question and adapting thought-shaping questions, no-oriented questions, and labels to start to readapt and reshape the what's your budget idea. We can start to come up with how things fit it. If you haven't already figured it out, a label's great by itself. A label followed up by a good no-oriented question or a calibrated question that's got a ready-made label to follow it up. That's the best way to execute skills in tandem with one another. Similarly, accusations, audits, and proof of life work very well in tandem as well. And so we'll talk about that more specifics next week. But take the Ackerman method, digest it, look it up in the book and refresh yourself. Take a look at the recording to give you some reminders if you need it. That is a ha skill at best. And when I say ha skill, we've been talking a lot about shuhari lately. Shuhari is a Japanese martial art concept that has to do with levels of advancement. In a nutshell, shu is beginner, ri is expert. Ha is when you're working in the middle where you're past beginner level, but you're not so comfortable with the skill of the technique that you're using that you're creating your own rules yet. You're still doing things kind of verbatim and still getting your reps in, but you got a really good solid foundation. Ackerman is in this ha place, right? This middle category. It doesn't exist in ri. Ri has a lot more to do with taking what I understand about how human beings tick and how they think and how they respond to value and dollars and designing my own approach to get them to bid against themselves based on the tactical empathy that I execute. That's when you're really in ri. Now, how am I supposed to do that is a baseline for it, but it is not the end all be all, right? It is, if anything, it's the first stepping stone for moving from ha to ri in the bargaining process. And so knowing, and I'll give you some insight right here as we're wrapping up our last couple of minutes. Knowing that how am I supposed to do that is in fact an assertive move. We call it tactical empathy because it's something we teach, and tactical empathy is our umbrella term. But it's not, has nothing to do with understanding their perspective. So that's the first thing we need to notate. When we use that approach, it has nothing to do with understanding, verbalizing, or creating trust with them. It's essentially a really nice way to go back and try something else, right? What you presented me is completely unacceptable, and you got to go work on it some more, tinker with it a little bit more, then bring it back to me when you've done some upgrades, right? That's a very blunt way to do it without using those words. And so, knowing that we want to lead into that with tactical empathy, and then we create this position of go back and work on it again. How does that inform us on creating our own rules for being most effective? And this kind of goes back to Chris. I know I've been focusing on you a lot today. What it takes for Chris to be most effective, or for any of you to be most effective at the table, is going to be different from what it takes me to be most effective, what it takes for Sandy, what it takes for Troy, et cetera, et cetera. Number one, because we're all different people, right? This isn't really a one size fits all. There are guidelines to how people tick, and then understanding how to navigate within those guidelines using an empathetic approach. But I can't tell Christopher exactly what it's going to take for him to be most effective, because he's got to figure that out for himself. And once he's got a really good understanding of how all these things fit together and what he does naturally, and then also how the counterparts in his world tend to operate, he's going to come up with the best formula for his success than anybody else will. And that same idea applies to everyone that's here with us today. And so keep that in mind, right? It's almost easy to get distracted with trying to follow everything that we teach to a T, right? We want to follow it exactly the way Chris said it, or exactly the way Sandy laid it out, right? That's a good start. The reality is you're still hindered by that position, because we're not creating anything for ourselves. And then the other thing that that does for us, we try to create wins or successes as notches on our belt. We don't learn from wins and successes. We learn from making mistakes. And so I've kind of always hated the metaphor, like, go break some eggs, right? And, you know, so everybody uses that. But the reality is, you're going to have some missteps. You're going to have to screw some things up in order to figure out exactly how to get it right. And unfortunately, there is no shortcut to that. You know, what we learn with loss is not something we can ever attain from wins. And so I guess where I'm really going with that is, don't be afraid of it. You know, at the very least, don't be afraid of screwing it up. Because if you're here at all, chances are you're already pretty good. And you know that, and you're just trying to get to the next level. Understand that part of the next level is taking what you're learning now and actually doing it wrong, whether on purpose or by accident, just to figure out how that informs you. Always remember, price is still just a term. And what it takes to make the other people whole, or the other side feel whole, does not equate to a win-win.
Steve, what other high points do we need to hear? I mean, Danielle's been very generous so far, and I love what she said. I mean, it's really encapsulated what I was hoping we could get across and helping people understand. It's about everybody getting better. Positive sum game.
I think what's fascinating, and Danielle can speak to this, is the journey itself. In the beginning, like one of the points in the beginning that you brought up, you know, big challenge, not going on a listing appointment without a commitment that they're going to list, which is unheard of in real estate, because every seller expects the agent will come out to the house, you know, look at the house, give their whole presentation, and then let them decide what they want to do. And you know, one of the things you brought up is not going out to the house without a commitment that they're going to list. And so in the beginning, when, you know, that was a big hill to climb in the beginning. And there were some real rough spots, because when, you know, you got to be terrible in order to be good. If you're not willing to be terrible, you're not going to get great at anything. And so she had to be willing to do things that she had never done before. And, you know, that's not an easy conversation. What do you mean you don't want to come out to the house? What are you talking about?
Everybody else is. How can you not?
Right. And, you know, another thing that you brought up, you know, when someone refuses to be a victim, that can bring out predator behavior. And Danielle started running into that. And when you don't know where that's coming from in the beginning, right, you don't have a frame of reference and someone beginning to attack you, that doesn't feel any good. And, you know, and she's checking herself. Is it me? Is it my tone? Is it what I'm saying? You know, why am I getting that reaction? And so, and Dan Young get into more. So in the beginning, like, that was a big mountain to climb. And now it's about, how can I get the call down to 10 minutes or less? That's what it, how can I determine whether I'm the fool or the favorite? I don't care which one I am. How can I determine within 10 minutes? You know, it started out with, you know, 40 minutes, then 30 minutes.
Hour and a half.
Yeah, I mean, the Zoom call, you know, and now it's like the conversation is, how can we just find out now, fool or favorite, and be done with it? And but, you know, this has been over a 3-4 year period of time of trial and error and trial and error. And, you know, one of the things that I think I said to Danielle up front that really helped her, and I use the analogy with Tiger Woods. When Tiger Woods won his first Masters tournament by 14 strokes, you know, young kid, early 20s, beat the world of best golfers by a million, he went to his golf coach and said, I don't like my swing. I'm winning, but I'm not in love with my swing, and decided to retool his whole swing. And it took him 1 year, 1 year. Now, this is Tiger Woods. This is a guy practicing every day. Took him 1 year to hit the ball once the way he had envisioned he wanted his swing to be. And then it took him another 6 months to groove in that swing. Well, in that 18-month period of time, he didn't win any golf tournaments. And the press was on him, and everyone was on him. Tiger Woods, flash in the pan. What happened to Tiger? After he got that new swing grooved in, he won 10, I believe, 10 of the next 14 tournaments. And I, you know, I shared that with Danielle, that you may take a dip in performance in order to experience a real spurt in growth. And that, and you can comment, Danielle, I think that allowed her to relax into this space of, it's going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And no more, I had to take and be okay with no more blood money and no more, you know, and a potential dip in performance in order to come out on the other side with something I would be really excited about. It has been an insane journey I've been hung up on and yelled at, and everything you can think of. Did we lose you guys?
Like, no, I'm still here. I'm sitting here, probably sitting here with my mouth open in admiration.
But because, you know, here's what I'm up against, is when I'm a top agent in my geographic area, and I have strong digital marketing skills, and I've really embraced social proof through online reviews from going a long time back, pre-Yelp days. And so I get a lot of calls from the internet, and sometimes they're my people and they've become wonderful clients. But a lot of times they have someone in mind, and often that person has less experience. And often they don't do as good of a marketing job. And for what, they don't have the same track record. And so the people are you know, wanting to double check that. And so they want to do their due diligence. And so the obvious choice to do that with are the experts that you can find online that in any, you know, any field, but specifically for real estate agents. And so I get a lot of those calls. And at the end of the day, they end up wanting to go with the person who has less experience and less negotiation ability, less marketing prowess because of the relationship, you know, because of some sort of connection or something that they have with them that makes them feel comfortable with them, that they were comfortable from the beginning, and they're just double checking. And so now I'm at this point where what I want to do is actually tell people that. And that's where I'm playing with now, is just saying, you know, here's what we're looking at. Like, here's what often happens, and see if I can just get to the truth. Because if that's what you want, I'm happy to answer your questions for a few minutes and give you that second opinion you need. But it's kind of like a doctor or a lawyer, when you go get a second opinion, like you'll get 15 minutes of someone's time potentially for free, but then that's it. You have to hire me to get the full strategy and the full technique. And that's where I'm prioritizing my time, is for the people who are hiring me so that they can get that expert. That, I don't know, that kind of, we were rambling, but
no, that was cool. I mean, you had so many cool things there, which is exactly what, when people get to the level where you're at, you know, we got a new phrase construct that we're thinking about now called Shu, Ha, and Ri, which is martial arts vernacular. When you're in Shu, you're a beginner, just do what the master says, you know. Do what Steve tells you to do. Say it the way Steve tells you to say it, word for word. Don't think about it.
Yeah.
And then you start to get your repetitions in a little bit. And you know, there, maybe there be a chaotic period of time where you feel very unsure. You feel awkward. Maybe you're getting weird responses. Maybe you're getting hung up on. Maybe you're getting yelled at. But then when you get into high, you're beginning the middle range, you're beginning to develop your own rhythm. You're beginning to see what other, quote, masters say and the elements of what they say and how that fits into your thinking now. And you're seeing things, stuff coming at you. And then in Re, the expert level, and by the way, all these skills are perishable. I mean, like golf, you don't keep playing, you're going to fall back down off the mountain.
Okay.
In Re, you're making up your own rules and you're trying new things and you're taking, you're probably advancing the thinking. And that's exactly where you are now by saying, like, if I know this is going on and I know how to tell people honestly with integrity without hurting their feelings, let me see what happens if I just tell them, look, I know you're looking for due diligence. I know you got a favorite. You know, you're a human being, so no matter what the fact, logic, and reason says, you're still going to make a bad decision, which is go with your favorite instead of me. But, you know, give you a taste of what a top agent can really do for you if you ever change your mind, which then the last impression is a lasting impression. You're going to convert them down the line because you're a top agent for good reason. They're going with someone with lesser skills and abilities than you, which means that's a one and done deal for them. But you've left a great last impression on them in a very short period of time. Which if they're ever going to come around, that's the highest percentage chance of them coming around.
Let's go to another big topic. And in many ways, this is an organizing principle that permeates everything that we're teaching and coaching right now. And this is something, unless you've been introduced to Chris, unless you've been part of my coaching, this is not anything that anyone has ever thought about. It's not anything that anyone has ever taught you. And yet it's present 100% of the time. And this is the concept of the favorite or the fool. Most agents, when they get a call from a potential seller saying, I want you to come out and speak to us about listing our home for sale,
most agents are elated at that phone call. And they want to jump all over that phone call. And when they go on that appointment, whether it's via Zoom now or whether you're doing it in person, however you're doing it, they go out with the idea that the prospective client has an open mind and they have a shot at getting that business. You have taught us that things are very different, that there's no such thing as an open mind. And in fact, the client's mind is probably already made up, or at least 50% of the way made up before the person goes out on that appointment. Speak to that concept, the favorite or the fool.
Yeah, you guys know the phrase, you know, if you don't know who the fool in the game is, who is it? Probably you. So how do we begin to, you know, how come these guys, again, aren't smoking something? After you get off this call, go look up human decision making. And you'll find out that when anybody engages in any kind of a buying process or negotiation process, they start to gather data. You're the vendor of this product. You're the vendor of this service. Do they go to you first when they're still trying to figure out what to do? No. When you're trying to decide to buy something, to acquire a service, to do anything, and it doesn't matter if it's business to business or business to consumer, because this is all the same. This is human nature thinking. You start gathering data. And so by the time you talk to the vendor, your mind is at least 50% of the way made up. And that made up. That's what the data shows us. It's actually closer to 80% made up or completely decided before they engage in a call. They're looking to you as the competing bid. They're looking to find out what you do to make sure that their favorite does it. They're going to pump you for information. Again, you don't got to take our word for it. Go start looking up human decision making as people are gathering information and narrowing their choices. They're narrowing their mind. Now, they don't mean to be malicious. They're not doing this maliciously. They're not intentionally playing you for the fool. But this is the way human beings make up their minds. And this is the reason why one of the agents that we have coached, that Steve has coached, done most of the work on, but I've been involved with as well, when she adopted the favorite of the fool approach over the last year, she's gone out on 80% fewer listing presentations. She's working 20% as hard, 20% the same amount of time as before, and making the same amount of money. Working 20% as hard, making the same amount of money. Now,
this is someone doing $100 million a year in sales. This is a top performer.
And she got there the old way. She got there saying, like, look, guys, I don't know where you guys are from, but I got to $100 million in sales going out on every opportunity, putting in the legwork, you know, burning up the shoe leather, burning up the hours. That's how I got to $100 million. And what we said to her just bothered her enough based on her experience. And then we began talking about what were the criteria of clients that she landed versus clients that she never landed. And she began to discover the patterns of what made her the favorite and what wasn't. And now she's applying it actively. And imagine getting 80% of your life back and making the same amount of money. Imagine what that does in your quality of life and your hourly rate and what you're actually worth. So this is a critical, and it's probably the single most frightening concept that we coach people on. And it is how they begin to transform their lives and living in a less stress environment instead of worrying day to day where the commission's coming from.
So let's scare everyone even more. What we are saying right now is we are coaching our agents to not go on listing appointments unless they determine up front that they are the favorite. You know, talk about sheer lunacy. How can we do that and still look at ourselves in the mirror every day.
Well, the reality, you know, it's not you creating this environment. This is the reality of what the environment is. You are wasting someone's time. More importantly, you're wasting your time to go out on a deal that you're never going to get. You are giving away your intellectual property for free. I recently interviewed three vendors of a service, knowing in advance who I wanted. Who I wanted was determined by the advice from my trusted advisor. He said, look, I got two to recommend to you guys. One I think you should go with. Another one I think you should talk to just for contrast, just to know what somebody that you're not going to go with looks like. We're involved with the conversation with the third vendor. I'm sitting there listening. I teach favor to the fool, and here I am playing this guy for the fool. I think of myself as an open-minded person, and I remember listening, and we talked to this guy on the phone for over an hour. And the whole time I kept asking myself, am I playing this guy for the fool? No, I would never do that. Is this guy ever going to get our business? Well, no, he's not recommended by our trusted advisor. No, he doesn't fit the profile of what we're looking for. Well, why are you talking to him? Well, I guess I'm hoping he says something important so that I can make sure the favorite does it. He did. And we took that information back to our favorite and said, hey, look, we want you to do this also. I'm not a bad person, according to me, but this is human nature. And the recognition of this dynamic is critical for the success of you as a professional and for your ability to give your family a better life. This exists. We teach you how to recognize it and how to cope with it.
So what we're coaching people to do is, rather than going out on the appointment and trying to win the business based on a presentation, what we're saying is recognize that the prospective client, their mind is already made up, or at least 50% made up. And what you're trying to determine, are you the favorite or are you the fool? And there's five specific criteria that you can tap into to determine this. So when someone calls you and says, we'd like you to come out and talk to us about selling your home, you're going to say, would you be opposed to having a 15 to 20 minute conversation by phone or Zoom first? You know, is now a bad time? And assuming they say, yes, let's talk now. The first thing you're going to figure out is, are they calling you or are they calling agents? Are they specifically calling you, or are you just randomly being called because you're a real estate agent? And one of the concepts that you teach, Chris, is proof of life. Is there a deal here, and is there a deal here with me? So speak to the idea up front of saying, why me? Why did you call me? Why is that important in terms of this concept of favorite or fool?
Well, and you touched on one of our magic words. Ladies and gentlemen, we could go into great depth on you being careful with the word why, but the only time you should ever ask anybody why is when it triggers them to defend you. You know, with all the, there are a lot of real estate agents out here. There are a lot of people that are really talented. Why me? Now that's an emotionally calculated prod. Because why always makes people defensive, always. And the only time you want to use the word why is when it triggers them to defend you. Now, this is a test that hasn't failed us yet, but we've got a number of backup ways to confirm it. Here's what's going to happen. They'll tell you right away. If they tell you right away, with their mind 50% of the made up already at least, they're already envisioning doing business with you. You are getting solid data back right away that you are the favorite. Things are starting to look good. If they can tell you, there's going to be two other responses. One is to put it back on you. Well, why wouldn't I? Or, of course, that's up to you to tell me. Ladies and gentlemen, we're here to tell you right now that they just told you that going into this conversation, they had no vision whatsoever of doing business with you. You have now begun to fall into the category of the fool, the competing bid, the person they're never going to go with. If they can't answer it, or if they put it back on you, that's bad news. Now, what you do with this as you move forward is position yourself as best as possible to pick them up after the other agent fails them. But you've just been given some really solid data on whether or not you're the favorite or the fool by using the word why. And this is the only time you should ever ask anybody why. Using the word why up front to see if you can trigger them defending you.
And you're very definitive about this. Agents always need to ask why me and what they're looking for. Is there a specific reason why they're calling you? And then rather than asking, are you interviewing other agents, you would label it and say, you're probably interviewing other agents. Who are you interviewing? And why are you interviewing them? You're very definitive. You want to know whether or not they're interviewing other people. You want to know who they are and why. Why would they be talking to them? Speak to that.
Yeah, and then let's do a little adjustment. When you're asking about why they're talking to other agents, change your why to a what. The other times when you want to ask why, just simply change it to what and say, all right, so I know you have a good reason for interviewing other agents. What is that reason? You want to encourage them to talk to you. Now, you are gathering legitimate information here. You're beginning to show them from the very beginning that you're a calm professional, because if you are the favorite in the game, there's no reason for you to cut your commission. If you're the fool in the game, there's no reason for you to cut your commission. So you're beginning to position yourself to have the full fee, full service agent conversation by demonstrating to them from the very beginning what full service looks like. And what full service looks like is you're asking questions in a polite and deferential manner to understand everything that's going on so that neither you nor them are caught off guard by anything in a process that you should have anticipated. So from the very beginning, you're demonstrating to them what a full fee, full service agent looks like.
So are they calling you or are they calling a random agent? Second, do you fit the profile of what they're looking for? The best indicator of future behavior is past behavior. Exploring the idea of how they've made these decisions in the past, what's important about that?
Yeah, you know, this is one of the five most stressful events in our entire life. If they've made this decision in the past, they're not going to make it differently this time. They're going to go based on what happened last time around and what that taught them. Did they pick an agent, if they went through this before, based on a recommendation of their trusted advisor? If this is their first time through, what are they likely going to do on one of the five most important transactions of their entire life? Go with the recommendation of a trusted advisor. Who is that trusted advisor? Are you on that trusted advisor's recommend list? I'm here to tell you, if they're making one of the five most important decisions of their entire life for the first time, to think that there aren't going to be trusted advisors having the dominating say on who they pick, that's just not a full appreciation of how human decision making is made. They're not out picking, you know, a pizza off a menu. This is one of the five most important decisions of their life. How are they going to proceed through this decision making process? You need to know that. And Steve, we got to keep an eye on the clock here too, because in about 2 minutes, we're gonna have to make sure that we let people know what they're supposed to do after this.
Okay. So, are they calling you or are they calling random agents? Do you fit the profile? The other three criteria, which we get into in our monthly calls: A, are you making an emotional connection? B, is the conversation collaborative, meaning is it a two-way conversation? And three, are they willing to make some type of commitment up front, whether it's having you go last, and you do want to be last, that puts the odds in your favor, or will they meet you in the office rather than their house, or will they make the ultimate commitment that they're going to agree to do business with you before you come out and give your presentation? So what we're saying to all of you, there is a real methodology for determining upfront whether you're the favorite or the fool. And again, this is an organizing principle. You have to ask yourself as an agent, do you make a distinction between high probability opportunity and low probability opportunity? We're teaching agents to focus on high probability opportunity. What's important about that, in the end, when you're the favorite, they're going to pay you 6%. They're going to pay you your full fee. It's going to be less stressful because the conversation is going to be collaborative, and it's going to save you an enormous amount of time because you're no longer chasing after business you're never going to get. Going back to something Chris said earlier, it's not a sin to lose business. It's a sin to take a long time to lose business. And many of you are guilty of that. You're taking a long time to lose business.